You are listening to the Massive Report podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Massive Report podcast, the quarantine edition. We are here recording on Zoom, still in our homes in various places around Columbus, and in the case of our guest today, Matt Bernhardt, around the country. Matt, how you doing?
Not too bad. You know, I guess it's a Saturday that my calendar tells me, so.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to matter anymore what day of the week it is for most people, but you know, some people are back to work, I guess. So maybe for them, it matters more. But we're still doing our thing here. And throughout this quarantine, we've had various guests on who, you know, in some way have had connections to Mass Report and obviously the crew. With no soccer to talk about, we thought, you know, kind of diving back into our history a little bit and people that have contributed in various ways would be interesting, especially with a lot of new readers and listeners. You know, maybe they don't know or don't remember, haven't, you know, really done the research on kind of how we got started and some of the people that were involved. So Matt is our next guest. And Matt's going to be an interesting one, I think, because not only did he help with Mass Report, but he's a longtime crew fan and a guy who has a lot of data and whatnot on the team. So we'll dive into some of that as we go. We've also got Patrick Goldan here. He'll have some questions as he knows Matt, has known Matt for quite a while, and Sam Fahmy recording things for us. And Sam, obviously feel free to jump in with any questions or side stories you guys want to add. But Matt, we'll get started the same way we kind of do with most people we have on. What got you into soccer? Obviously, you know, nowadays, it's one of the more mainstream sports, but that wasn't always the case. What was it that drew you to the sport, and when did you really kind of get a passion for soccer?
Oh, that's a good question. So I grew up in Northeast Ohio, and in the 80s. So in Northeast Ohio in the 80s, you played soccer as a kid and you watched indoor soccer. There was a team with the Cleveland Force, which was in the heyday of the MISL. They packed the Richfield Coliseum, the same indoor arena that the Cleveland Cavs played in, 19,000-20,000 people. It was just as much, I was a kid, so, you know, I have force colored glasses on, but they played just down the road from where my family lived. The tickets were cheap. So, and my parents were like, "Hey, great. You know, we can do this. So this will get us out of the house for a little while." And so that was the first experience with soccer as a thing to watch was, hating the Pittsburgh Spirit and the Chicago Sting and, the Baltimore Blast and all that. And, you know, supporting, players who would then go on to feature for the crew in Timo Liakowski and Brian Bliss and things like that. But that was the first sporting, like, fandom experience with soccer for me, and also my first experience hating a team owner when the team folded right when I was in like eighth or ninth grade or something. And I think we can skip past that kind of emotion. Crew fans are very familiar with that. And then the owner folded the team, the league limped on, the crunch came back a little bit later, but by that point I was older. I think I was off in college. I got back into soccer in 94 with the World Cup. Not to the Sam's Army degree. Sam's Army was born out of the 94 World Cup, so it didn't exist at the time, but that kind of reminded me that soccer was a thing that could be watched. And then, you know, by that point I was at Ohio State, I was doing my undergrad, and the way my class schedule worked out was that I was frequently out of class when the Champions League games were on, and I started watching Champions League games on ESPN, ESPN2, and so that 94-95 period was like, oh wow, yeah, this sport is really cool. And you know, this is outdoor, it's not indoor, but it was a very, very cool, and it was And it was, you know, about that time I remember thinking like, hey, you know, it was late 95. Because I remember thinking, I think I remember something about Columbus getting an outdoor team, which was obviously after whatever June or July date in 95. And then that got me into like rec sport soccer and the NAS mailing list, and hooked up with a bunch of other, you know, early crew fans who were realizing what was about to be joining up around us. And so a bunch of us hooked up and said, hey, this is great. You know, the thing we've been watching on TV and the thing we've been kind of seeing national team games on every so often is about to be here. So let's grow with it. And so we started, I mean, that was when Wrecking Crew started as the first most prominent supporters group. I remember I didn't know anything about them. I was at the first game. My family came down from Northeast Ohio, and we all went to the game together. And, you know, my mom made flags and Dr. Seuss hats for my brother and I. So we were, you know, getting rowdy and everything. And I remember the Wrecking Crew guys looking behind going, hey, get down here. You rowdy folks behind us should be down here with us. And I can't remember if I ever actually stood with them, but yeah, because the internet group was trying to get support crew going. Wrecking Crew was there. And yeah, that was the, and then from there, you know, the supporters culture in Columbus grew with the team, I guess.
It's funny you mentioned those indoor soccer days. I grew up in St. Louis, and so we had
the Steamers.
The Steamers, yeah, eventually became the Ambush. And actually, the other day I was wearing a shirt that I have that is from 1996, and it's from a summer camp I attended, and it was it was down to my ankles at the time, but like they gave them out to all the kids, and I was the last one. Or one of the last ones, so I got a shirt that was far too big, but it still fits me now as like a workout shirt and has a few holes in it and whatnot. But those games were fun. I don't know how many people listening are familiar with those leagues, but you know the scoring was high and you know it was pretty good soccer. You know if I know there's some people who aren't big fans of indoor soccer, but my dad and I used to go to those, and I really enjoyed that. And you know, it come to find, like you said, guys from that league end up in MLS years later playing on, you know, full 11v11 fields and whatnot. So those are certainly fun memories. Let me ask you this, as you talked about the supporters groups kind of starting at the very beginning, what was that like in comparison to what people are familiar with now, the Nordic and even back when guys still, you know, congregated in the North End zone with the Army and whatnot. How was it in 1996 when maybe, you know, there wasn't the experience of previous supporters groups to build on? What was your experience with those groups?
It was, I mean, it's hard to, it's kind of like embryonic versus the teenage. I mean, you know, same species, but vastly different in its development. I remember being in the North End with Contractors SC in 99, 2000. We were doing the jersey flag and things, and dreaming that like at some point maybe we can fill the entire section 137. And remember being really encouraged that like we took up whole rows and like the bottom half of the section was, you know, people. And I mean, at the time, Columbus started out with, you know, fans in the corners of Ohio Stadium. There was Wrecking Crew in the Southwest, and there was Support Crew that became Contractors SC in the Northwest. You had the group from Shadowbox, like all the Shadowbox performers all loved soccer. So when they weren't performing, they were on the east side somewhere doing their thing. But at the time, like the big groups out of the chute in around the league was like DC United, Barra Brava and the Screaming Eagles. They had great camera position and they had big numbers and they had big energy. And everybody kind of looked at, you know, what DC United games had and was like, wow, this is the thing that we could become. You know, being soccer fans, you of course look around to other leagues that have longer history. So, you know, there was that sense of, you know, which countries are we going to take the, you know, where do we see things cool that we want to try, basically? Not necessarily like, which culture do we want to import, but like, where do we see things cool? And you know, what songs do we want to sing? What songs do people sing elsewhere? And how can we do that? And all the while dreaming like, you know, it would be great if there were more people. It would be great if there were more people. So now, you know, when I see what the Nordek does with multiple sections of full people and the Tifo Sweat group and like every, you know, the way that the supporters culture is in Columbus is everything that I didn't dare to dream of in 2001. I am incredibly impressed at how their community has grown and how the people who, you know, were in that community after me. And I think we're now several generations after me, but you know, it is amazing to see. And I'm incredibly proud to, you know, some, whatever role I spent was like, oh my God, like if what I did helped bring this about, then that's great.
It's funny. I was watching one of the MLS has done those classic games where they have, you know, players who were involved and stuff talking throughout. And I think it might've been the original game, the clash in DC, because Jeff Agus was on there. And I remember him talking about Bar Brava and just how that was, you know, you didn't see that at many other stadiums around the league, at least to those numbers. And like you mentioned, yeah, kind of centralized in the stadium and whatnot. And I remember thinking at the time, like that was the pinnacle of fandom. And, you know, obviously you had Ohio State football and things, you know, other examples like that, where there's certainly, you know, rowdy sections or students or whatever, but it was definitely different watching that. And then obviously as European soccer became more available and the World Cups, as you mentioned, seeing how that supporters culture existed in other places was really interesting, and you know, something that I think attracts a lot of people to the crew, probably to MLS as a whole, just, you know, being a part of something. And I think there's a lot of camaraderie. There's also a lot of drama from my understanding of being in those supporters groups, but you know, I think there is a family feel to that, and obviously that's helped grow in Columbus. From being a guy who was a fan in the stands to then, you know, helping out with Massive Report, what was kind of your transition? How did you get involved? You know, I know Patrick and Sam were obviously a big part of a lot of people becoming involved with it, and we've talked about their stories on previous shows. But what was your kind of introduction to the online community, and then eventually doing stuff with Massive Report?
So, okay. So that, you know, in 96, in those early days, when you formed a supporters group, you needed a website. And, so I was, you know, I can't remember if Support Crew ever had a website, but Contractors SC definitely did. Shout out to Dave Collins, if you're out there somewhere. You know, so we needed that. We have a website, we have to put things on it. And at the same time, I've been a geek my whole life. You know, I'm a nerd, I'm a geek, I'm a whatever. So to help me kind of understand what I was seeing, I mean, for as much as I played soccer and I watched a lot of soccer, part of the way that I work through understanding something is to make records. So I started recording things that I saw and keeping track of what the games were and what the results were and writing match reports to put out on the crew fans mailing list. And so I just started, you know, doing the things that came naturally to me and putting them online, sharing them on the mailing list. That grew into CrewFan, that was one of the early fan-supported or fan-generated contents around the website, right, around the league and the team. And at about, I forget what year it was, 2001 maybe, the guy who was running the team's official site, Shane Murphy, reached out to a bunch of us and said, "Hey, you know, I've got the contract to run the team website, and I want you guys to be a part of it because I see what you do online." So he reached out to Jamie Felrath and myself, and I'm going to forget names, and I apologize in advance. Shane had a friend, Al Brzezinski, and there were a couple people who all kind of came together to run the team's official website in those 2001, 2002, I think, seasons. Maybe 2000. I can't exactly remember when the transition happened, but that was, I remember thinking at the time, like, how did I get to this point where I'm involved in a team's official website? And then when, you know, we got media credentials to be in the press box to help generate the coverage, that was like, how did I manage to get to this point? I can't draw you. For as much as I just told you the story, I can't give you a map to figure out how to get to that point. So we all did that. Then when the league took all its websites centrally, or at least as many of the contracts as they could get centrally, I think the revolution lasted for a long time outside. Yeah. But when the league took everything centrally, we didn't have a thing anymore. So Shane said, "Hey, I'm taking my staff and we're going to make Soccer Capital News." And that folded into the Match Night Network when Match Night Network went belly up. Didn't go belly up, but Lee decided that it wasn't something he wanted to invest resources in anymore. That's when, Patrick, I'm trying to remember the guy's name who organized Massive Report initially.
Bob Stein.
Yeah, Bob Stein. And that was when, he had been doing stringer reports for local wire service or something, things like that, right?
Yeah, he was our AP writer. And so Match Night was kind of there and Soccer Capital News was kind of there. And then there wasn't much for a while. And before that, there was the Dispatch and really nothing. Rich Fiddler had
something. Oh, yeah, that Hunt Park Insider.
Hunt Park Insider for a little while.
I still have that code somewhere.
And then I started a blog in the beginning of 08, and then a couple other people, and then Mitchell started a blog right after that. And then in 09 2010, the Massive Report was, Bob wanted to kind of try to pick some people who had been doing coverage for a little while. And so Sam, yourself, Jonathan Smith, and myself were our initial staff along with Bob.
Yeah.
So, it was kind of barren there, I would say, through the terrible mid 2000s for the crew, and then kind of blossomed after that.
It kind of came together in 2008. Where have we heard that story before?
Right. Were you a big soccer guy?
Was I a big soccer guy?
Like the website Big Soccer, the message?
Oh, yeah. I've got an account there. I did a lot with I haven't been there in years now, I think.
Yeah.
I was super involved in Big Soccer before I kind of started to transition out of the supporters group. Because I remember being on Big Soccer a lot in the lead up to the 2002 MLS Cup. Because that's when we hosted the supporters summit that year.
Yeah.
So and at that time, Twitter wasn't a thing. So if you needed to communicate with other soccer fans, it was message boards and mailing lists. So I was on Big Soccer about that. And around 2002, I started the transition away from being a supporters group, some of the drama that was involved and some of that and growing pains and everything else. Yeah, so I kind of left the world of message boards behind around there, I think. The other thing you had asked about was the data side of things. That became kind of the thing that I was really interested in learning just in general. I became interested in databases and recording data. I worked at the School of Architecture as a computer support person. I got really interested in, data-driven websites and programming. And I said, let me start keeping track of players who might be coming into MLS. So I started keeping track of player profiles in a Word document, and that quickly fell over. And I'm like, okay, well, let's try an Excel sheet. And that worked out far more than the Word document did. But that then, as I started recording more and more data and getting more, trying to track more and more stuff, I started getting more and more technical sophistication in what I was doing. And so by the time Match Night was running, I did the central scouting database behind all of the Match Night network. And that's become the kind of thing that centered a lot of the activities that I've done since, is trying to learn the data science and learning the data modeling to answer the questions that I had about how like systemic forces happen around the soccer world. And that's why the attendance tracking that I do is there. That's like, I just get curious. I'm like, well, where's the data that I can find, and how do I reason about this and keep track of it and put it out there for people to think about?
So that was one of the things that was kind of interesting in your story. A lot of times when you look at something like supporters groups and data analysis, a lot of those are seen as, you know, opposing forces, and you know, the data gets in the way of the passion.
Yeah.
And I was kind of wondering, has that evolved how you watch a game, or is that always an undercurrent? And the supporters group was kind of like that, that entry point, and kind of married some two forces that are oftentimes seen as opposite.
So I think it's interesting to try to think about like that dynamic. Yeah. Because I think that there's, I try to stay out of the debates about, you know, whether analytics brings something or takes something away from the sport, because it's just, to me, it's a framework that individual people will bring to an activity, and some people will find it useful and some people will not. And if you don't want it, then great. If you do, then fantastic. You know, you have your flavor. I have my flavor, and I don't, and to me, this also relates to some of the kind of soccer proselytizing that I see going on about, you know, people who get upset about, you know, this or that person taking pot shots at soccer. And I'm like, you know, we don't need soccer doesn't need everybody to like it. Soccer is not that needy. Soccer is, you know, perfectly viable, and it will be growing. And yes, we need more fans and more people support. But the way to do that is not to try to force everybody to like us or to like the thing that we like in the way that we like it. Because I think that I've seen too much drama and too much people who should be on the same side ending up at odds with each other because you don't do it quite the way that I do it. And I don't have any interest in that kind of, you know, debating, and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't move the game forward at all. So I think I think it's, maybe you can look at it and say, I know I made my choice. I left the supporters world behind, but I think I'm just as capable of sitting there and singing in the Nordic and clapping and getting rowdy for as much as my head is full of numbers as not. You know, when I watch the game, I get curious because things happen in front of me. I'm like, I wonder if that's ever happened before. Or I wonder, when was the last time this thing happened? Or, you know, what's the context for this action? And that's what drives a lot of the data collection, is because I'm curious about, has this ever happened? Has anything like this ever happened before?
For some people who may not be familiar, hopefully most of our listeners are, massivereportdata.com, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sure people want to know if they're interested where they can, find this, your information. What's, give us maybe a couple examples that stand out data wise of things that you found that surprised you, or that, you know, maybe people won't know. Are there a couple things that maybe come to mind when you think, you know, you mentioned, has this ever happened before? Maybe something you found along those lines or something like that.
So, I mean, I remember, I don't remember anything that was like really shockingly surprising, in part because I've kind of come to my terms with there's a lot of statistical analysis that I need to know a lot more math and a lot more data science around before I can really start to ask. So I remember feeling kind of gratified to start to piece together the team attendance patterns and the ways that the crew as an organization, as a corporate entity, functions within a market, and understanding some of the forces and how being able to talk with the people on the ticketing side and understanding how the organization goes about the process of making sure that people are in the stands. That was really gratifying to learn. I remember also on the playing side, getting to the point where I could look at player turnover and understanding how, because I think this was a thing that after a time with Tom Fitzgerald, it became clear that he as a coach kind of struggled with. And, you know, when do you like let formerly key players move on? Because my theory on that is that for as long time he was a college coach, he didn't have to worry about moving players on because they graduated. And, you know, you looked at he had a core of players that he was able to partially inherit, but also grow over time, and they reach their pinnacle. And I think he started to struggle after a while with, you know, how do you move forward from that? How do you get that juggernaut going that some teams over time achieve? And so I started looking at, you know, what player turnover looked like and how, you know, when, what does a stable, successful core on a field look like? And how many players do you need showing up game in and game out? Versus, you know, for a team that's struggling, and, you know, you can't keep putting the same 11 guys out there every time when you're losing all the time, because you have to change things. So I remember being really interested in looking at that kind of turnover and, you know, what does that look like in terms of getting a stable core together and how many players is that? Can you hang a successful team off of three people? What about eight? And, you know, I remember seeing things like, you know, when you get like kind of like six players who are there all the time and they're predictably in the lineup, you have the option to fiddle around the edges and in a productive way versus, you know, well, screw, you know, all these guys are benched. And then you do the same thing again the next game. You do the same thing the next game, and you just get no chemistry going. So I remember things like that being really interesting.
The analytics that they have now, you know, obviously coaches can look at more numbers and whatnot, especially in MLS, because that, as we've talked about on previous podcasts here, you know, that wasn't a thing in early MLS. Coaches were, and I mean, even as you know, we've mentioned before, Steve Nichol, when he was the coach of the Revolution, which doesn't seem all that long ago to me, you know, was a guy who just kind of did things the way he wanted to, and numbers didn't matter to him as much.
Yeah.
You know, now coaches have a lot of information. I think you can base, you know, do we move on from this player or not based on a lot of numbers, and you've got, you know, you can tell how much distance a player can travel in a game over the course of the season and things like that. But even still, I think that's an issue that coaches face. I remember talking to Greg Berhalter. It was during the 2016 season, maybe like late in the 2016 season, when it was clear that they weren't going to you know, make the playoffs and whatnot. It may have even been after the season, but just him talking about how he struggled. You know, obviously they had success in 2015, made it to MLS Cup, but you know who he should have brought back, what he could have added to the team to push them. And he ended up deciding, obviously, that the core of that group was going to stay and he wasn't going to make too many tweaks. And he thought that they could do that. But that's something he looked back on as probably an issue with that 2016 team was, you know, it was the same group of guys and it just didn't carry over to the next year. So, you know, even a guy like him who has a lot of data and is very analytically driven doesn't always get it right. And, you know, there's a lot that goes into that. I think it's interesting when you talk about the attendance, because obviously that was first of all, I think it's always been kind of a sore spot for Crew fans. It's more so during the Save the Crew era when obviously they were being picked on and, you know, a lot was being put on the internet about attendance and whatnot. But even before that, I remember seeing attendance numbers compared to DC or, you know, LA in the Rose Bowl and stuff back in the days. What kind of things do you find when you look at attendance numbers specifically for the Crew in terms of fluctuations and, you know, what builds for the best attendance? Obviously winning helps. But you know, I know you've tweeted a lot about this when you get numbers, what do you find when you break down attendance figures?
Well, I think the attendance for a game is only part of the story, because I think the attendance patterns that the Crew, it's been a while since I've talked to anybody on the sales side, but so I'm hoping that this is true. But season attendance patterns are the thing that I think is the most relevant, because if you plot game by game attendance patterns, there is in Columbus a very clear pattern of a, you know, reasonably sized crowd for the home opener, because you've got a lot of lead time, and then you've got a trough that you get through in the games 2, 3, 4, and 5. And then, you know, the later you go and you get bumps and it, you know, a lot of things play into that. I think the cold weather hurts. I think lead time hurts. I think being in school hurts. So, you know, as you get farther into the game, into the season, and it go, those games 6, 7, 8, 9, you get warmer weather, you get, you know, more chance for the sales staff to piece together group ticket sales. Hopefully you've got a team that's performing well that can supply that kind of a bump to the sales figures. I'm not actually convinced all that much that, there is an effect in that, you know, a team that does better, there is a portion of the population for whom that will matter. I am not frankly convinced that that's a huge factor. Okay. I think there, and I would really hope that from the perspective of the sales force, that cannot be the thing that you rely on. because your team will not always be good. And if you are banking your attendance on competitive success, you are creating fair weather fans. That is not the way towards success in a sporting enterprise. And I remember the rebuild that the team went through after, what was it, the 2010-2011 season, when a lot of the front off the sales staff was restructured, and they brought in people from like the Philadelphia Eagles and the Tampa Bay
the Rays.
That, you know, these were people who came from a sporting enterprise where with the Eagles, you didn't need to do anything. You just needed to just publish the schedule and the ticket calls started coming in. And that's the structure. That's the goal that, you know, I mean, that's what you have in places like Seattle and in places like Atlanta. They're not relying. I mean, yes, they happen to be good, but they're putting up an operation where they can sell those tickets, whether the team is good or not. And that's what the goal needs. That's what I think the goal needs to be. That's what we have at Ohio, you know, with Ohio State football. The years where, you know, whatever year that was with Luke Fickle, where the team was finished like 6-6. But Michigan game or the end of the game, the end of the season that year, those tickets sold just as much as they did at the beginning. And the 2012 season, those tickets were just as hard to find. So that I think needs to be the goal from an organizational perspective is, you know, you want to drive that. There's this concept of how do you get fans from the kind of casual, like one time, you know, you go as part of a group, and then like, okay, well, great. Now maybe I want to buy a ticket on my own outside of my employer, outside of the group that I got a low cost ticket to. And then how do I get from, you know, a game or two a year to I'm there most games. And then how do you get to like, wow, I've been to a lot of these games. And I remember this was the path that I walked. I didn't intend on buying season tickets, but I realized towards the end of the 96 season that I'd been to every home game. I'm like, well, I mean, if I'm going to be going to every game, I might as well buy season tickets.
Right.
So I bought season tickets in 97 because it just made sense. And then you keep the season tickets for as long as you can. And I think that's within the season tickets, you try to get people to, you know, invest a little bit more and be more a part of the community and more a part of the team. And maybe, you know, buy a little bit better seats so you can see a little bit better. So there's that constant, like, how do you set up that kind of a funneling operation to try to, you know, whet people's appetite, get them excited, give them a good time, and then hope they come back for more. And if you can do that with enough people over enough time, with enough energy and enough factors coming together, then you've got sellouts game after game, regardless of whether the team on the field is good or not.
And I know during the pre-court era that was still the sales funnel that they were trying to build off of group sales that were trying to leverage that. And I know that was a desire in the McCullers era and then in the pre-court era that they wanted to get past that so that it was an event that people would go to without having to necessarily get that group ticket lead up. And I think that's where when we're looking towards the new stadium, that's the try to position Columbus Crew Soccer as something as an event that stands alone, much like a Columbus Blue Jackets taken early on in their in their history or something to that effect. It's hard to recreate Ohio State football. You know, very few things in this world are Ohio State football, but you know, I think if you're able to capture what the Blue Jackets had early on with something that's exciting, that's the big jump. And so I think it's an interesting time to be ticket watching, you know, for Columbus Crew Soccer, because things, the old assumptions are going to change in some regard.
Yeah. And I really can't wait to see how the crew as an organization and how the support, the community around the team reacts to this, because I think, you know, the opening of the stadium is an amazing opportunity, but that opportunity has to be capitalized on. And I think if you look around the history of the last 20, 25 years of the team, of teams who have gone through a stadium change, some teams have been remarkably well positioned to take advantage of that, Sporting Kansas City. Other teams have really squandered that. And I think, you know, in hindsight, I think some teams realize that maybe they had a better situation in their previous stadium, Rochester Rhinos, that they have a hard time recreating in a stadium that it was supposed to be much better than their original one. Now, I think the siting for the new stadium, that, you know, where it is in the city, its proximity to everything, I think that's a very positive thing. For as much as I love a whole lot of things about Moffray Stadium, the sighting has always been a challenge, and I'm hoping that the team sees these kinds of stories and the organization is positioned to capitalize on the opportunity that the new stadium presents. The stadium will not guarantee results. It provides an opportunity to change the narrative. So if they can deliver on that kind of early enthusiasm that we saw with the Blue Jackets, or that you see with other really successful around stadium, big successes around new stadium openings, you see how that opportunity can be capitalized on.
Matt, there was a lot of talk during the, Save the Crew movement about what was being done with tickets and the numbers being announced. And I remember you keeping track of a lot of that. What did you, from looking at this, from the longevity perspective that you have, what did you see happening on the, I guess that year plus, where, the numbers seem to change all of a sudden?
Yeah, I think so. And this was a story that I remember putting out multiple times because I mean, the group, the section of people that were in support of a team wanted to tell the story of like Precourt did all these great things and then he couldn't bring it over the line. That's where it's important to remember when the rebuild happened and when that influx of a new approach came in. What I saw with Precourt was he came in right after that. And he kept that going. Whether he obviously didn't do it well to the degree that he wanted it done. But I think he thought that he'd be able to do certain things and success would come. And then I remember in 2016, early in 20, I think it was 2016, those early few games, that trough that I talked about, that kind of got filled in. And I remember that year thinking, wow, something new happened. Like this is a pattern, like those games 2, 3, 4, 5 trough didn't happen. And I'm thinking, that's weird. That's really interesting. That's really encouraging to see because, you would see those early games, you're like, there's a lot more people in the stadium than there typically is on a game 2, game 3. And thinking, okay, this could be good. And then 2017 happened and the trough was back. And it was like, what happened? Like there was this concerted growth that had been happening from the rebuild. It was a continuous process of attendance growth that then in 2017, there was a reversion. And I remember thinking this bears watching because like there were signs that something was happening. And I don't know if this is going to be a blip or if this is which is the blip? Was 2016 the blip or is 2017 the blip? And then, late 2017 happened and we realized, oh no, this, what we've been seeing all in 2017 is this is the signs of an organization that has started to lay the groundwork to start moving. And they're not investing in the market the way that they used to be. For whatever calculation they made, that happened. And then it became a question for me of putting that context out there and talking about what patterns I had seen and what we had all seen in the stadium. And trying to make sure that was the framing, because the framing shouldn't be, this is a team that deserves to move, and this is a fan base that doesn't deserve a team, because I think that's not, and ultimately, thankfully, enough people agreed with that framing that we're still here talking about it.
Absolutely. Patrick, you said you had some questions you wanted to ask. Feel free to...
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about the early progression from indoor soccer to being in Columbus and saying, hey, I got more soccer here and, being a part of that and moving to the front office temporarily and then media. The one transition that I do wonder about is how does it go from being such a weekly part of your life that you go and you're at Moffray Crew Stadium several times a year to being, a remote fan and watching from afar, and especially during the Save the Crew era where, there's lots of memories there. There's, 20 years of memories, and then you're watching things from afar all of a sudden, and it's not the same part of your daily life.
Yeah. So I think that's something that I'm still, coming to grips with. I remember when I told, so I got the job out here in, what was it, late 2012? Yeah.
And you're where, Matt?
I'm in Boston.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah. I got a job at MIT, which was like my mothership. So
nice.
It's like, oh my God, you want me to do this? So that was amazing. And it was, you know, I hated leaving Columbus, but the job was amazing, was an amazing opportunity. And I remember when I told people around Ohio State that I was leaving, they're like, so what, are you going to become a Revolution fan now? And I remember thinking, no, that's not the way that's not the way I do sports fandom. Right. Some people might, but that's, you know, I now have more history with this team and this community than I've got with anything else in the sporting context. That die is well and truly cast. There's nothing against the Revolution. I like the Revolution supporters I've met. I've had a great time at away days at Gillette. So I don't want to make it sound like I'm a hater of the New England Revolution. It's just not my community. So in that sense, like, it was never a question of adopting a new team, but it has been a really different thing to go from, you know, like you said, Patrick, I was at every game. I was in the interview rooms. I was doing a lot of the things, and now I'm watching a game and I'm reading Twitter a lot. In a way, the way I navigate that is by, I did a lot more data collection, and I started to do more with the, like, on a league level, trying to, you know, watch. I needed more context, right? I couldn't just be a Columbus context person. I needed more context to try to help understand this. And so I was working on that kind of a, like, trying to scale up my harvesting operations. And I had written this Python library to help do the data manipulation side, and finally replace some really old VB scripts that I'd been keeping alive on life support for a long time. And that was, you know, doing the same thing that I'd been doing since 2001 of, there's a thing I want to know. So I want to build these skills in my professional life. There's this passion that I have for soccer in my personal life. Let's use soccer to learn job skills, and let's use the new things I'm learning at my job to benefit my soccer side. That all kind of was shaken by the Save the Crew thing, because it became clear to me that, like, what I was contributing to this ecosystem that had a flaw with the force, this was the second time through this. And I think that's part of why I took some of that so personally. It was like, I remember watching my team leave and feeling like, what, that was it? Like, that, I don't have the force anymore. Like, well, who gets to tell me this? And so then, I remember watching the earthquakes go through that and the Soccer Silicon Valley group. And I remember thinking in those early, like, that, you know, late October, early November, thinking, like, this is, we got to try to follow the San Jose playbook. Our best hope is to try to negotiate leaving the team history and try to get an expansion team. And I thought that was the winning scenario. That was the best we could achieve. And then as time went on, and we realized, and all the kind of carefully constructed narrative on the part of Precord started to fall apart. And, you know, we started to see movement on the Columbus side, like, wait, we could have a bigger win here. Like, this could actually work. And that was really, really energizing, you know, because it was great to start seeing those signs of life and those signs of hope for not only me now, then in 2017, 2018, but also for me in 1988 and 1989, who, when the force folded, that was it. I mean, there was no protracted campaign. The announcement came out, and then that was it. And so that was like, that was part of what I, like, helped me through that. And now, I mean, now that we're past that, it's kind of, you know, we got through that, you know, with 2019, and it was the year that shouldn't be. And we were all just so happy to be in existence. And I remember thinking in the lead up to this season, like, okay, so now the honeymoon's over, you know, this is the season that's going to allow us to build momentum for the new stadium opening next year. Let's do this. Let's get hyped. And then, you know, everything falls apart and the world changes. So we'll see what that comes. We'll see what that comes like. Cause I was in the lead up to this conversation, I was realizing, like, you know, I go a long time now without looking at Twitter, and thinking, you know, I was thinking like, should I go back through and look at all the stuff that happened around, like, what's like, I know there's talk about like individual players starting to work out, and, you know, the season hasn't been written off. I know some of the Euro leagues have actually called the seasons by now. So I'm really curious what the startup is going to go through, but I feel like, you know, I'm going to have to go through my own kind of spring training process and trying to remember, like, oh yeah, no, we signed that the Lucas guy, and I have to, like, you know, oh yeah, our goalkeeper is Eloy Room. Okay, good. I can remember this. I'm going to have to go through a lot of that stuff myself to get back into this, and I can't wait for it. I've been telling people here, like, I want to go to sports events and I want to be among 20,000 people again and not worry. But it's going to, I'm going to have to fly to Columbus to go see more games, I guess, because I want to get back to that. But the last couple months have been like just massive recalibration of what takes up my mental energy.
That is interesting because, you know, MLS is in a different place than a lot of other leagues. You know, either, you know, the NBA, the NHL, a lot of the European soccer leagues were towards the end of the season. So you had a season that, you know, if you needed to end things, at least you got the majority of stuff out of the way. And obviously that's complicated in America because of playoffs and whatnot. But, and then you have Major League Baseball, which hadn't started yet. But MLS, you know, you got those two games in. Where does that fit in if you have to come back with a, you know, if you do conference only or things like that? And I know that's stuff that's part of the discussion. And yet from a fan's perspective, especially if you're not a diehard fan who spends every waking moment thinking about the Crew, you know, there were a lot of new pieces, and even some of the guys that came in at the end of last year that, you know, maybe throughout the off season, you kind of had to remember and whatnot. I think a lot of people will be in a similar boat. And I do think it's funny that you mentioned that San Jose Earthquakes model, because that was, for a period of time, what looked to be the Crew's only, you know, saving grace was, okay, they're going to allow this city to keep, you know, the name and the colors and the history, and hopefully we can show that we can get back, that there is a passionate fan base. And I think a lot of people were, you know, obviously not excited for that, but it was something to cling to at a time when, you know, it honestly didn't look like, unless you were, you know, the Morgan Hugheses of the world who always believed that we were going to win this fight, so he says, you know, that was the thing you could hope for was, hey, well, you know, if worse comes to worse, hopefully we can get a team back here because we do believe we have the fan base and the infrastructure and whatnot. And I think because the team was obviously saved and that didn't have to happen, you know, people kind of forget that was a thing and a real idea. And even something the league had gotten on board with to some degree. I hadn't thought about that in a while. So that stood out when you mentioned that. And I don't even think about that with San Jose anymore. You know, I saw one of the replays I mentioned earlier was the 02 MLS Cup, I think, when they played here against the Galaxy.
Like, yeah.
In my mind, that's the same team. And obviously it is, but they did have those years where they weren't in existence and all those players were in Houston. Patrick, what else you got?
I did have, and maybe this will be kind of a capstone question, you know, given your history with the league and given following it for such a long time, what's your view on the changes over 25 years of MLS soccer? You know, on the field, things have changed. Off the field, certainly things have changed. You know, what sticks out in your mind?
I mean, on the one hand, it's growth. I think, you know, the league that at one point had 10 teams and, you know, the average attendance was 13,000 or something like that. And you're rattling around in NHL and NFL stadiums and, you know, you're hoping for national broadcasts on Thursday nights. And the supporters cultures were, you know, a couple dozen people behind a goal. Now, you know, we're up to however many teams. I honestly don't remember right now. And, you know, there's, yeah. And, you know, you've got, you know, groups, you've got in so many cities, you've got a much better situation. So I think from a organizational, from a systemic perspective, it's growth. From a supporter's perspective, I think actually this is a thing that I think there's a number of data points for the role of supporters to influence things. I think here of both the, you know, the effort by Soccer Silicon Valley to kind of rescue the San Jose group. I think of, you know, obviously the Save the Crew, but I also think of the early fight against the Shootout. And I think, you know, I remember wearing paper bags over my head in the North End because I hated the Shootout. I remember, you know, shortly after Garber became a commissioner, there was a game where he was at the stadium, and the game had gone to the Shootout. And as the contractors and everybody, I think the Army was there at the time, you know, we all turned our back on the thing because we didn't support what the Shootout was, but we saw Garber there. So we started chanting at Garber, you know, end the Shootout, end the Shootout, end the Shootout. And, you know, then in 99 came word that, you know, the Shootout would be ending and we were going to get extra time. And, you know, that was great because I think that was an example of the league seeing the pressure that the fans were able to generate to say, hey, look, there's a way to do this that we would like you to try. It doesn't happen often. I mean, I wouldn't say that the league has listened to every fan movement, but I think there's enough data points over the course of the 25 years that MLS has been here that I think there's an encouraging sign. There's an encouraging aspect there for would-be organizers and would-be people who try to influence the way something would go into the future to say, look, there is a little bit of a precedent there. And I think that's great. That's the thing I would like to see encouraged. Because I think whatever city you're looking at, I would like to see more supporters and fans in the stands. I'd like to see more energy. I'd love to see those trends that have started over the first 25 years continue on into the future. I think those are the things that I think of when I think back to what it was like at Ohio Stadium and what it was like in the early days of Crew Stadium, now Mafra Stadium, and now into whatever the new stadium name is going to be. Like, I'm really looking forward to seeing where that trajectory goes from here.
When, on a similar topic, we've talked with some of our previous guests just about, you know, the play on the field. And Patrick and Sam and I have talked privately. You know, I think that 0-2 Open Cup game is on YouTube now, the final. And it's, yep. You know, watching that, you know, watching, like I said, I watched the 96 final, or the 96 opener, and the 96 final's been on. Just going back and seeing some of those as they've replayed those old matches. And, you know, obviously I remember the league at that point, but it's amazing to me, and you can probably speak on this too, just the level that the league has evolved on the field. You know, not talking about the Shootouts and stuff, but just the play, you know, yeah. Tactically, the players that obviously have come to this league. You know, you can talk about Zlatan and Henry and those big names, but even a guy like Lucas Zelarayán you mentioned earlier, or, you know, a Guillermo Barros Schelotto, who, you know, maybe a bunch of Crew fans at the time didn't know, but clearly was a step above a lot of players in the league at that time and was a big name addition. And then they're, you know, every team now kind of has one of those guys. Just speak to the evolution of the play that you've seen over the years and how it's evolved tactically, player wise, you know, however you want to handle it.
So I think it's another example of that kind of growth. And I think in this case, it feels like it's a closing of a gap, because I think, you know, if you look back to like EPL games in 95, the game feels different now than you watched on Sunday mornings on, you know, and whatever NBC network you're watching. So I think, you know, and I think that's where the comparison of MLS within the global soccer community really starts to work, because, you know, yeah, if you go back and you watch the 96 opener or any of those early days, you know, the soccer itself will, especially if you're watching a game at Ohio Stadium, the soccer itself will not more than likely be great soccer, right? And you'll be able to see in how an individual player traps a ball or how often a pass goes out of bounds or misses its target. And you'll see, and you'll realize, like, the quality of players are better because they've grown up more. They've had a different, their path to this league is different. And now we're able to recruit players like Lucas Zelarayán. We're able to recruit players who, for even if, you know, you think about who came in that 96 season to kind of rescue the team, that amazing turnaround after Fitzgerald takes over, and you're introducing guys like Ricardo Irubaren. You're introducing Paul Caligiuri, who was a U.S. national team, but you know he wasn't like the Michael Bradley coming home from Roma. He was coming back from a decidedly different context. You've got Robert Warzycha, who was a Polish international, but you know I like Robert, but he was a Polish international who had been bouncing around with Everton, and now we're getting Scalotto, who was the legend at Boca Juniors, and we're getting Zelarayán in the prime of his career, being pried away from Tigres, right? So I think that the quality of play on the field has improved, and the gap between the quality of play that we see in Columbus versus what you see broadcast from around the world has closed. And I think both of those changes are worth considering, and I think they're both worth recognizing. But I think the thing that, I mean, to me, it's this is going to sound weird coming from a guy who left Columbus, but I think one of the things that I really like about the way MLS and different supporters groups can retain is what that local identity is. And to say that, like, you know, because if I think it's important not to chase the kind of quality of play argument too much, because if you go down that path too far, you're going to be watching Man U, or not Man U recently, but you're going to be watching Liverpool and Man City. And, you know, you can tell when I came of age, because it was Man U and Juventus were the two teams that I was like my touchstones, or Ajax. But, you know, if you go down the quality of play argument too far, you're going to end up watching games on TV from half a world away that you've never been in their stadium for. And I think the thing that's encouraging to me is that for people living in Columbus now, you can go to the stadium and you can see players like Lucas Zelarayán or Eloy Room, or, you know, up until this year, Will Trapp, who are there in your city. And, you know, the level of play has gotten better. There's enough history now that you can talk to people like me who can battle on about the way things used to be 20 years ago. What you're watching while you go navigate all that is a lot more like what you would see through coming in on, you know, NBC on Saturday mornings. And I think that's a special thing to be able to do. And I hope that continues to happen, because I'm happy that Zlatan never came to Columbus, or that it wasn't signed by Columbus, but I'm looking forward to there being more Lucas Zelarayáns. I'm looking forward to there being more Will Trapps and Chad Barsons and, you know, people like that, or Josh Williams, to that kind of marriage of the people who grew up idolizing the players in the field, then becoming players in the field themselves, and then also, you know, getting the best players from around the world to be able to come to Columbus and continue to kind of write the story of the Columbus crew.
Yeah, I agree. I think it fits the crew, Columbus, that type of, you know, the mentality, America's hardest working team, like that type of thing, you know, to build with guys that, you know, aren't these Zlatans of the world and whatnot. And, you know, I just think it makes a lot of sense. That doesn't mean you can't find a star, and I think they have, obviously, at various points throughout the team's history. But, you know, it doesn't have to – I mean, you know, if you could get a guy who's going to sell out stadiums, I guess that would be a good thing for the attendance stuff we were talking earlier. But I think with the way this team's history has been and kind of the way the fans are and whatnot, it all makes sense. Patrick, you have any more questions?
I don't. I was very interested to hear the changes, Matt's impression of them from now till then, because, you know, my time watching and covering the league, I remember that 2002 Open Cup, but you know, that was further down the funnel that Matt talked about. That was going to a couple games and then going to a couple more games and then going as a group and then, oh, it's time to go get season tickets because I've gone to everyone except one. And, you know, his first season tickets were in a good season with 1997. Mine were in the second half of it was the second half of 2005. I saw enough of the first half of 2005. Oh, yeah. Like I am in on this. So, and then I had season tickets for 2006 and 2007, and 08, so that worked out.
If you can walk that part of the funnel during those years, you deserve an award, my friend.
The 2006 team, I've said many times, holds a special place in my heart for that is some level of ineptitude. You know, yeah. when you're starting Jose Reyes like 20 games and, you know, you're picking up goalkeepers you haven't played in a year and a half because you have no one else. That's notable. I'll go with that. Not good soccer. That's notable.
Yeah. That was basically an expansion team, and it was not a good expansion team. I remember the plot that I do with the waterfall. We were showing every player in team history and every game in team history. The plot, the slope of the line that's, you know, generally about a 60-degree angle just juts horizontal because there were so many players joining and leaving the team at that point. It was an amazing thing to witness.
That does prompt one question. Does that plot look a little bit different in 2019? I was kind of wondering about that because it kind of had a 2006 feel to it about how much turned over and how much changed with, you know, people coming in and then people leaving. And it might not be to that extent, but, you know, good things happened after that. It might have taken a little bit of time, but good things did happen after just kind of rotating through a lot of things, a team that might have been getting stale like the 2004 team that, hey, you know, we went 17 games undefeated, you know. 16 yeah. of them were ties.
Yeah, nobody could beat us. We couldn't beat anybody, but nobody could beat us.
So
we won the Shield that year.
That was aside from the 2009 season. No, that was sadder than the 2009 season. That 2009 yes. team had some talent on it. You know, it's getting to the end, but no. When I look back at crew history, that's, you know, I look at the echoes, and I don't know if anything strikes you, but I look at that 2019 season as possibly a 2006 style. We're trying to find ourselves. So I was very interested to see how 2020 shaped up. Not that I was predicting MLS Cup, but a rebound with an identity. And so I guess we just have to wait a few more months.
I want that date to come, but I want that date to come at an appropriate moment. I'm really looking forward to seeing this team get on the field because I think, yeah, there was a lot of signs having gone through the unexpected frustration of 2019, 2020 felt like it could have been a good payoff. And now it's just a payoff that hopefully is a little bit delayed. I'm really looking forward to seeing that group and seeing what they can do together.
Yeah. And I think you saw, you know, the New York City game maybe wasn't the finest reflection, obviously being up a man, they only winning 1-0, you know, you would hope to dominate a little bit more, but that Seattle game, you know, you go there and you fight. I mean, obviously they were up and, you know, 3 points would have been great, but you give up a penalty kick, you're able to save that. And then hold on to get a point out there when Seattle really kind of took control of that game. You know, I think a year ago, this team, you know, obviously with everything it went through with injuries and the guys that were on the field and whatnot, you know, it's tough for me to imagine that they fight that way, which was a positive in my mind from, you know, the first two games, which small sample size to take from, but, you know, I think this team is certainly moving in the right direction. I think Caleb Porter has guys that, you know, fit what he wants to do and whatnot. So, I've said this a lot to people, but I think, you know, assuming the season comes back and they have a chance to really ramp back in the way they need to and everything, I think this is a good group and can do some things. But we'll get to talking about the team and what it will be as we get more information on what's going to happen. As Matt mentioned earlier, for people that haven't paid as close attention, players are back to training. They can train individually at the team facilities. I've seen some team Twitter accounts tweet out pictures of guys there, and it looks like people are generally wearing masks and whatnot. So I think that's a decent first step. It will be interesting to see what happens. Not that our country is the same as Germany, but with the Bundesliga opening up here in the next week or so, I guess, you know, how that's handled, kind of a, you know, potential blueprint for not only MLS, but other leagues to try and figure out how to get back. You know, we all obviously, as you said, Matt, want to see them get back, but we want to do it at the right time and make sure it, you know, doesn't endanger anybody or whatnot. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I think I've not been following the, how COVID-19 has been playing out within Germany specifically. But I think, I mean, one of the things that is really apparent to me from here in Boston is how different various parts of this country are experiencing this, because I know Ohio is starting to open up, right? My sister went back to work this past week.
Yep.
Meanwhile, here in Boston, we're still canceling events out through into the summer. Granted, I'm a developer, but you know, the library that I'm a part of is going to be closed to all comers for quite some time yet. Because if you look at where the hotspots are, that Eastern Seaboard, Boston to New York to Philadelphia to DC complex, that's where so many cases are. So, I mean, I'm hoping that, I find it really interesting, this notion that I was reading this morning about the league possibly gathering teams at a place like Orlando, and doing kind of neutral site games and like a tournament style or something. I think that could be really interesting, because the first games are going to be fanless, right? I think it makes sense to pick a place where the disease isn't as prominent and where you can do more people together more safely. But it's going to be a while, I think, before I in Boston can walk through the stands at Gillette, walk into the stands at Gillette and stand with anybody. So I'll be really curious, both as a human, how this goes through, but then also, you know, in 5 years, how this season gets viewed in the kind of context of that historical context we're talking about. Like, what does this do? Is this just an aberration, or is this an opportunity to like introduce other changes? Like, I've seen people calling for like the fall winter calendar now, which I'm not sure I support, but I'm just really curious what this is going to look like in 5 years.
And I know you were talking about how things are different in different areas, and yeah, so Ohio is still opening up, but they're still not one of the states where, you know, teams are allowed to practice. So, the individual practices, they weren't happening down at Obetz. They were happening in Orlando, and I saw Utah was out there with Real Salt Lake, and Portland, I believe, was on the field, and a few other places, Kansas City. But it's definitely going to be a patchwork type situation, and it's really challenging for, you know, our health officials, and it's really challenging for executives trying to figure out how to run their business.
And from a competitive aspect, right? I mean, mm-hmm. does Real Salt Lake just get to be that much better because they've been training for that much more? I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough to say. But I want to ask you a couple quick hitters, which is how we've ended this with people. And these are, you know, pretty basic questions. Just first one, your favorite Crew player of all time and why?
Oh man.
I meant not that easy.
Like, 270 some players. I'm gonna probably go, oh god, Ricardo Irubarren. He's a defender like me.
That's not a name we've heard from other people. Why is it?
I like the fact that he came back from multiple stints. He fought through a lot to get to this community, and to come back to this community. I remember him being a very tough defender, which went in my playing days, that's where I settled in. So I have a personal affinity to center backs. And for people who showed over time, that they wanted to be here, that counts for a lot in my book.
Your favorite Crew match you've attended in person?
Favorite's a weird word.
It can mean a lot of things.
I will say the finale of 2018, because I was there with my brother and my one sister, and it was everything going through that year. I remember having tickets for that game from the day single game tickets went on sale, thinking I was there at the first game, I'm going to be there at this game. I may be crying, but I'm going to be there. And it turns out we were smiling. So that is my absolute favorite game.
What did you do for the 2008 MLS Cup final?
I watched that game in Union Station at a restaurant in Chicago. Oh, wow. Because I was coming back from my best friend's bachelor party weekend. So I remember finding like a TGI Fridays or something and sitting at the bar watching that, texting with my brother and a couple people.
Quite the weekend.
Yeah. that was something.
Well, that's all I have. Sam, is there anything you would like to ask Matt? You're good. All right, Matt. Well, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it. I think, again, this was another interesting, you know, episode. We're trying to keep things interesting with no Crew soccer, MLS soccer to talk about. So, you know, diving into the past and different people's perspectives. You know, we had Jonathan Smith on, and he obviously, you know, has a perspective from the radio side of things and, you know, being a fan when he was and whatnot. So the data stuff I think is certainly interesting, and I hope people enjoyed it. It took an hour of my day that, I would have been not doing much and made it much more interesting. So I appreciate that.
I'm glad to be able to talk to you guys. It's always great to see everybody.
Absolutely. And, we'll see how long this goes on, but if it goes on too long, we may have you back on to just talk soccer. Maybe we'll do like a big round table of people to just talk soccer and, you know.
Sure.
See what happens.
I'm in.
Okay. Well, ideally we'll have soccer to talk about, but maybe we can work that in anyway.
Yeah. I read that as the prerequisite to your question. So okay. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you, Patrick, for coming on. Your questions were well thought out as always. Sam, thank you for handling things behind the scenes quietly. We do let him talk, folks. He's allowed. He just chooses not to. But we'll be back. As I'm sure listeners have noticed, we haven't done this on a very consistent basis. It's just kind of been when we've been able to find the time with schedules. While people aren't doing a ton, they still have schedules in their lives and whatnot. So we'll be back. I also have a couple new ideas for things we can do, but we'll talk about that later. I have to run it by the powers that be here. But we're enjoying doing this, so we hope you're enjoying listening to it. We'll be back with another episode soon. But again, thanks, Pat. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Sam. We'll talk to you guys soon.